Hello and welcome to Non-Breaking Space, which you can find online at nonbreakingspace.tv. Non-Breaking Space is a show where we'll seek out the best, brightest, and smartest people on the web and talk to them about how and why they do what they do. Your hosts are Christopher Schmidt and Dave McFarlane, two web designers, authors, and trainers who have a passion for sharing knowledge about the web. I'm Chris from Canada, a web designer and podcaster. Christopher and Dave have been invited along to help push the record button and keep everyone on track here on Non-Breaking Space. Our guest for this episode is Brian Hoff. Brian is a graphic designer living in Brooklyn, New York, who loves creating compelling and useful websites and memorable interactions across the web. When he's not designing, he can be found writing, speaking, and occasionally part-time teaching at colleges, all on the subject of design. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Christopher and Dave and their conversation with Brian.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Hi, Christopher. Oh, it's going well. I'm doing well. I finished up a book this week, and so just sort of relaxing and podcasting.
What book number is this?
This is Dreamweaver CS6, so this is like the 8th edition, so I've been doing it for like 10 years or something like that.
Congratulations, man.
Thanks, and then I'm off to start my CSS book next week, so.
Oh, man. Has anything happened in CSS? Unless...
No, not much, so okay. That's cool. It's going to be really easy to update.
Quick update.
Few things, new screenshots.
Yeah, just put the WebKit vendor prefix in front of everything, and then
I'm good.
Send it to the printers. Cool. Well, I'm really excited for our guest today. Really just talking a lot about design today. So let's just bring him on. Hey, Brian, are you there?
I am. Yeah, cool. Thanks for having
me. Hey, you're welcome.
Yeah. So cool. So Brian, tell us a little about yourself and how did you get into web design?
I went to school for it, but prior to school, I've always been interested in print design and mostly typography. I'm definitely a type nut, I wouldn't say school taught me much more than my passion kind of led the understanding of what I know today. While I was in school, I worked for Apple Retail as what they called a creative. I was a usability recorder, I want to say, for Apple as we help people understand Apple software, hardware, and just apply that to, helping them to understand it better. But it also kind of broadened my knowledge on how people interact with software and hardware. Which led me to kind of where I am today, as far as being an interaction designer anyways. I kind of hated working at Apple when I did. I'm a big Apple fan, but I didn't like working for the company. it comes down to I wasn't doing what I loved doing. After talking to people and them talking me out of quitting, I just ended up quitting and turned to freelancing. And it was around that time I started my blog, The Design Cubicle, and just kind of turned into much more than I ever thought it would be. And that kind of propelled my business and how things are going today. It's pretty cool.
So, you went to school for design, or you went to school for web design, or both?
I have a BFA in graphic and interactive design from Temple University's Tyler School of Art.
Oh, okay. Cool. And
like 7, 8 years ago now.
Yeah, cool.
So you wear a bunch of hats. You're not just like a web designer. You do print design, logo design, a bunch of different things all around visual design.
Yeah, I started my career doing print design, doing logo design, and that, I think most designers, we just kind of get bored and we want to move on to the next, greatest thing. I'd say the past 3 years have been really focused on interactive design for mobile and for web platform.
Mm-hmm. So you're a big type nut. You've talked in the interviews that I've read about you that you've done. You've talked about typography and your obsession with it. Where did that obsession come from? Why do you love type so much?
I don't know. There's something about just properly placed text on a page. I honestly can't explain it. it's just something beautiful about the curves of type, and you know, how it just tells a story more through, you know, in a way it serves as a graphic, you know, throughout the page and throughout the web. And that's kind of like what I like to bring to my pages, you know, to my, my work as well, is, you know, kind of tell a narrative, through the typography.
Right. Yeah. My background before I got into the web stuff, I was a, you know, I did layout. I was a typesetter. I mean, this was way back when, before there was even the web, really. And I loved type. I mean, we'd get these big type books and you just flip through and you could just look at all the different fonts and compare them. And, you know, where we worked, we had, of course, the entire Adobe font folio, and it was just really cool, cool, beautiful stuff, which makes it interesting that you've moved over to the web, because really typography is, you know, compared to print, is so limited, you know, what we can do on the web compared to print is so, so different. So how do you, where do you try to find the beautiful places on the web for doing your typography? I mean, what are the...
Well, I mean, recent advances, you know, with web fonts, like services like Typekit and FontDeck and, you know, those other, you know, fonts.com and all that, they, they've really, you know, helped push things forward, recently in the typography department, which has really been exciting for me. You know, to be honest with you, I wouldn't say that I was, extremely excited about the web up until maybe about 5 years ago, to be honest. It was limitations and everything didn't, everything felt stagnant and not dynamic, like it would, on a, you know, in like a magazine, for example.
Right.
You know, it was just something nice to see like a different layout every, you know, time you turn a page. And, you know, I try to bring that to my work as well. I try to, you know, a lot of clients that want to work in a CMS, I really try to push the capabilities of most CMSs. And my Adam usually has a headache, but I try to push that as much throughout the entire site and really focus on telling a narrative as much as possible.
Right. Yeah. That's one thing you don't really get with, you know, CSS or like web pages. CMS is all about the templates. In fact, when you know, with WordPress and blogs, you know, software came on the scene, it was kind of like, there was a cry, but a small one, but in terms of like how we would craft these individual pages or our websites with like these outrageous, you know, table, you know, markup and everything like that. But everything was kind of like this handcrafted experience. And that kind of died a little bit with you know, the like, you know, bringing the CMS, you know, with via WordPress, and it wasn't just like big boys having their own custom CMSs anymore. And yeah. And so I think you know, Jason Santa Maria kind of tried to bring this in back, and I think, you know, his ideas still hold true if you want to go there with the kind of the art direction theme on the web. I just, you know, find like, you know, what you probably hit across maybe with your clients is that to come up with those type of mock-ups
for the MBA, for your MBA clients,
for CMSs is like, you know, just probably a little bit of a nightmare for them just to integrate.
It is. It's, you know, WordPress is really, I'd say that especially in the last two releases of WordPress, they've, you know, they've kind of moved more, you know, towards becoming a CMS for, you know, sites rather than just for blogs. It is getting a little bit easier to, you know, incorporate that into work. But, you know, all clients, I mean, they, you know, they don't want to sit here and, you know, they're paying enough for you know, a lot of times they're paying enough for websites. They don't want to, you know, have somebody, you know, coming back to you every you know, 2 months just to change something around. So,
right.
You know, I say like 90% of our clients, you know, they want it built into a CMS so they can easily update. But, you know, that also has its limitations because I don't want to just, you know, create like a dumping ground for text to, you know, not be a unique experience from page to page.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it basically seems like the bloggers who are doing it themselves are the ones who can create the custom, you know, creative direction on their sites, like Trent Walton, you know, yeah, where he does a lot of every single page is different, the typography is different, and, you know, but that takes time. And I mean, that's one of the problems with the internet and with the web. It's, you know, we need to get our content out quickly, and that's what CMSs are there for. So it's kind of a fight against, you know, good design versus, you know, rapid publishing.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you have some favorite typefaces that you just adore?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, lately, when I've been starting out a lot of my just mock-ups and getting kind of like the hierarchy down, I've been really going back to PT Sans and PT Serif. They're just such hard-working fonts lately on the web. They read well at really small sizes. They work at large headlines. PT Sans is a really good typeface right now. I've also been having some fun with I've been redesigning Outbrain.com's website, which probably should be launching I'd say in a few weeks. And we used Freight Sans throughout the site, and that's just another hardworking typeface as well. It's nice having that, working with typefaces that have large families. That way you can kind of set the ultimate hierarchy
right
easily.
So now, are there other web fonts that you love, or is that what you are kind of into?
I can't say I love them I can't say I love one or the other. I feel like from month to month it changes for me. A few months I was on a slab serif kick. I'm on right now I've been using a lot of Freight Sans. I don't know, maybe that's because the past 4 months of working on the Outbrains that I've been staring at in the face. It changes from time to time.
So how do you spec type for the web? I mean, it used to be like when I did print design, I would pull out my big font folio book and I would just flip through and it's categorized and I'd find these fonts, that I loved, and then you'd buy them from Adobe or whatever. How do you go about saying, I would need some web fonts? Where do you go to find your list?
I always try to buy fonts as much as possible and build my own personal collection. I usually kind of, I get away with it by most of my clients telling them they need this. A lot of times they do. But a lot of times they want to see the comps with the actual base working on it. So it just makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Usually I try to make sure that, one of the services like Typekit or Fontdick, they actually are hosting it. So I'll usually start there at first. I'll, kind of browse. I tend to use 99% of the times I tend to use Typekit. Their library is really extensive, and I feel like it focuses more on quality. Quantity and as opposed to I have nothing wrong with Google Web Fonts. Actually, PT Sans is free on there. It's just I feel like you're weeding through a lot of amateur typefaces as well.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think Adobe's bought Typekit and before then Typekit was a kind of like a clearinghouse for font font houses to come and make money by renting out their fonts and all that sort of that. So through the subscription model. But I thought it was a brilliant move that Adobe bought Typekit, because now they have this service where their fonts that they couldn't probably, if they went directly to font houses, they probably couldn't negotiate a deal to have a Typekit service and stuff like that. And which is awesome for Adobe, but which I found with the Adobe cloud service now, you get Typekit baked into the subscription model for the Creative Cloud, which I think is just...
Well, I'm curious to see if they do any kind of integration with their CS applications as well. With FontShop just released an extension for Photoshop that allows you to access their entire web font library and then use them as well. Suitcase Fusion has a plugin that works with their database as well. So I'm hoping it goes the same route, because that would be fantastic.
I found that's kind of stuff is like very evolutionary and kind of like something I think Adobe would just definitely bake into all their apps. It's just going to take time for them to do that. Now that they've actually bought it, I'm actually kind of surprised they actually were able to get Typekit into CSX just as easily as they did. I think there's still kind of little bugs here and there, but be able to buy it and then release CSX, which is takes some time to like all the ducks in a row for that. It was to me it's not great.
It was nice that Adobe finally listened. I'll tell you what, CS6 is a major just overhaul of especially, I haven't used much of like Illustrator yet or InDesign, but I know Photoshop. They it's good to see them finally listening.
In what ways have they listened?
Just like features, like in particular, like searching your layers palette, like for like a name, so you could type in and it'll just kind of filter by like if I name the layer, you know, hat, it'll just show everything, every layer that's named hat. I mean, obviously that kind of goes with, you know, having to be organized. But as long as you're organized in your layers and you're naming them, you could just, you know, search that way as opposed to just having to figure out which layer is which.
Right.
You can actually apply fills and borders now to shapes easily. Mm. There's actually, this is my favorite. This is one I've been waiting for. You know how InDesign has the ability to set like a master, you know, headline, master paragraph, right, and then apply that? Mm-hmm. It's now the same Photoshop where, if I'm using a certain font and then I realize that I want to change it to another font, instead of having to go into every, you know, every PSD or every instance of that font, you can actually just change it with one click of a button, which is a huge time saver.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So do you find that you quote like live in Photoshop more than like say Fireworks or?
I've never gotten into Fireworks. I know a lot of diehard Firework fans that just will, you know, argue the opposite. You know, I think they both work equally as well. I mean, I'm just more comfortable with Photoshop and using it, you know, at least 10 plus years or whatever. Right. But yeah, I mean, teach them, I guess, in that department.
Yeah,
I don't handle, as business has grown, I don't handle much of the development side. You know, I obviously kind of lead that, but I don't touch the coding these days.
So, I mean, that's leads to kind of a question about process. I mean, one of the things that's difficult for people who are getting into this industry to sort of grapple with is what am I going to do when I become like a quote unquote web designer? Because the job titles that we have there aren't really job titles for web. You know, I'm a front end developer. They might be doing coding as well as design, working in Photoshop. Maybe you could tell people like, what do you do? Like if someone comes to you and says, hey man, I need a new website. What is it that your actual process and what do you deliver?
So I guess I wear multiple hats. I guess I'm the project manager, I'm the designer, I'm the art director, and I kind of oversee some other people. I have an illustrator and that works part-time for me now, and another guy, Adam, that handles all the development work for my company. So, I kind of lead that. I lead the interaction design, any kind of visual design, user experience design. That's pretty much how, you know, all the responsibilities that I do. Because I'll kind of lead you through how, you know, beginning to end with a new client. We have our clients kind of fill out a project worksheet. This kind of gives us an overview of, you know, what the project is, what their goals are. And to be honest with you, over the years, I've added more questions. I've taken away questions, but I feel like it really gives me an overview of who they are as a person. It's amazing what somebody filling out a project worksheet really does. I feel like the people, to me, like when somebody takes it, you know, you could tell when somebody takes only a few minutes to fill it out and their responses are just, you know, it's sloppy in a way. And you almost think like, you know, if this is your project and you're going to be investing, you know, money into this, and this is supposed to be your heart and soul, and you're taking, you know, a mere 2 minutes to, you know, unthoughtfully answer these questions, you know, a lot of times, you know, why would you want to work with somebody like that? So, you know, we tend to filter out, you know, we're in a position where, you know, we do receive a lot of work requests. So it gives us the ability to filter out before even stepping on a phone call. I'm definitely one. I try to stay off the phone as much as possible. I feel, you know, if I was to take a phone call for every new client, that's pretty much all I would do.
Right.
So that gives me the ability to say, like, listen, like, you know, here's somebody else that might be able to help you out better, or, you know, we're not a good fit, or, you know, hey, let's proceed. And then if we do choose to proceed, we'll set up a phone call with our client just to get a more detailed description of their goals and, you know, what they're trying to achieve. And then, you know, we'll pencil them in for a specific date, you know, do all the proposal stuff, get that out of the way. And then once we start, I'll set up another kind of a kickoff call, which again involves another worksheet. Mostly the worksheet kind of involves a milestone checklist to just kind of make sure everything is in order. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we charge by the project, which kind of allocates for a set amount of time. Mm-hmm. But you know, you run into that problem. You know, a lot of designers are, well, you know, how many changes? You know,
right.
Where do you stop the changes? So that way, our milestone checklist kind of just says, like, hey, listen, like, this is what we're going to do this week. You know, if it goes over, usually it's not our fault. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of protects us for saying, you know, keeping everything on track and mm-hmm. helping the client to understand, you know, how this process moves about.
Yeah, like I think when I worked for agency, like our MO was like, you get like maybe two changes, and then after that, you know, we have to start billing you for that. So it was like,
yeah.
You know, unless it was like our fault for doing something, then we'd do it, you know, for free. But yeah, so it was like kind of written into the sign-offs that we would do too. So it was.
I try not to show too many. Yeah, you know, I'm a person. I like to do something right and do it right the first time. Mm-hmm. So like, I know some agencies will actually show multiple concepts, and you know, I'm totally not a fan of that. Simply for the fact that I always feel like the client will pick the worst one. And they honestly will pick the worst one.
Or they'll try to mix and match your designs. Right? They'll take something from one design and put it on the other one.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I try to stay away from that scenario as much as possible. So, like, I'll often, I actually just wrote a post about this, about on my blog, about, you know, showing the client until you're happy with what it looks like. You know, a lot of clients, I call it client nervous syndrome. If you show things too early throughout the process, they get real nervous and they start changing things that are unnecessary, and it doesn't allow you to get from the start of the process to the end of the process of what it looks like. So yeah, I try to keep everything in order as much as possible to you know, show them as. I don't want to say that I don't include them in what's happening, because I definitely touch base with them on a day to day basis. But, you know, sometimes they're just notes, sometimes it's just thoughts, sometimes it's, hey, you know, I need some clarification. You know, it's hop on the phone call. So I try to include all my clients as much as possible and as little as possible.
Right. So after you do this intake, you have an initial questionnaire, and then you talk to them and have another sort of to really figure out what it is they need. What's the first thing you show them? Do you show wireframes? Do you work on a logo? Or does it vary?
It completely varies. I try not to have a strict process, because it, you know, I guess, again, I get bored. And I feel like things don't, you know, evolve in a strategic way. I mean, sometimes we'll start with the site. Sometimes we'll figure out the branding first. Sometimes wireframes are required. Sometimes they're not. I try not to be too strict on the process. You know, sometimes you do need wireframes. You know, you're looking at, you know, if you're redesigning, their mobile site and or you know, a web app, and you know, you kind of look at what they already have and be like, you know, this is a disaster. Let's just kind of start from scratch. You know, then I'll definitely wireframe. Other times they have a lot of good, you know, a lot of good foundation already laid. So you know, I would say, you know, let's you know, wireframe more roughly, or let's you know, skip it all together. Really depends.
So do you make comps in Photoshop and show them? Say the actual web design. You got a website project, and now you're about to unveil, you know, sort of the first go with your client. Is it? Do you comp in Photoshop?
I do. Yep.
So how do you deal with, you know, now we're in this world of mobile and responsive design, and we've got, you know, breakpoints that we're designing to and stuff like that. How do you like first educate your client in the fact that we now have these different canvases we have to design for, and then how do you comp that to sort of show them, take them through visually what it's going to look like in different devices?
I'm kind of lucky in that sense. We work with a lot of clients kind of in the digital channel of things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like a lot of our clients are quite educated, you know, to an extent.
Right.
A lot of times, you know, we'll have to show them examples. You know, I link my clients to a lot of articles written all the time, actually, and, you know, just to kind of, you know, help them understand, you know, why I'm making some of the decisions or why they should be going in a certain direction, you know, than they initially had thought they should be going in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I try to, you know, I mean, you know, there's no doubt about it. The mobile usage is, you know, at an all time high, and it's just going to keep growing and growing and growing. So I try to, you know, you know, at least educate them that, you know, listen, even if we don't have a full-fledged mobile version, you know, right. we should be thinking of that down the line, because if you want to, in 6 months, if you want to, you know, turn this into a, you know, a mobile version, like, it'll scale down really nicely.
Mm-hmm. Do you have clients who are, you know, aware of responsive web design and are asking for that? Or do you have to, are you even doing that? Are you guys doing responsive web design or mobile, a separate mobile site?
Yeah, definitely. You know, right now it's a lot of the clients, you know, it obviously it's going to cost, you know, more money. So a lot of times, you know, I'll present, you know, option A and option B. And again, I feel like the past year, they're not quite ready for a fully responsive site. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I try to, you know, I'm designing I'm redesigning a CrossFit application for a company. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I can give too much information. I'll just say a company.
Well, there are screenshots on Dribbble about
I think the name is I cropped out the name though.
Okay.
So I don't. if you're out there listening to this, I mean, right now we're not directly designing for a mobile experience at this point. But from the beginning of the process, I'm thinking about how, you know, they just don't have it in their budget right now. So, but we are thinking about how this will scale down. So when they are ready to approach that, it's going to be a much smoother transition into a mobile site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like a site for CrossFitting, when you have people just on the go and it's like, you know, I'm going to assume it's for like tracking progress that the people are going to take their phones with them if they can, or maybe, you know, just leave them handy, you know, if you will, like whatever. But, you know, you definitely want to have that that application to be mobile, you know, friendly.
So. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, cool.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, it's just, you know, it comes down to budgets. I feel like a lot of times for client, I mean, I want to be able to provide the best experience for them without, you know, compromising, you know, the business side of things on my end. So, yeah, there's a lot of like, you know, hey, let's do this and we'll revisit this in 6 months. And that's exactly what we're doing with them. You know, we're saying, okay, hey, let's, you know, you have this site. It's, believe it or not, I mean, I think most of their people are using their, the actual browser site right now, as opposed to their mobile app. And I think that maybe it might just because the mobile app is just not where it needs to be.
Right. Like, the thing I always talk to about is, you know, I bought the Amazon Kindle Fire, and I was like, man, I am so ready to see what, the official Twitter Kindle app is going to be, for Fire, like in the, Facebook, you know, official, Facebook app for Kindle Fire. And they just launched the app and, you know, got them from the, you know, Amazon store, and it just launches the browser and it goes to their websites. And I'm like, what was the point of this again? I have like no idea. Like, so, I mean, to me, it's great because it speaks to the strength of the open web a lot. So it's, you know, basically we're just like, you know, hey, here's an app, here's a bookmark to place on your nice phone. And then
I mean, the thing with the responsive design too, it obviously has its limitations, and, you know, obviously it's still in very early stages where, you know, a lot still needs to be figured out. But I feel like a lot of the sites now, they just, the responsive sites, they work for a specific, you know, type of site. You know, they work for blogs. Any text heavy sites work great for. You know, I think like, for example, Starbucks has now a responsive site, and I think they failed miserably at it. They just, it lacks personality. You know, it really loses their branding, I feel like. And, you know, and because, you know, they pretty much stripped all graphics and, you know, made it text. You know, now it looks like a site from the, you know, the early 90s.
It's the Pearl Jam of sites.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's, again, it's a little bit of the limitations, and it's also a little bit of, you know, this, we're still early in this responsive realm, and, you know, let's figure it out together. And I think that's what's kind of great about the community, because I do see a lot of, you know, great leaders kind of pushing this further and figuring out new things. And it's really cool.
Right. So like, so you're like, I mean, I would take a moment to talk about the Starbucks just a little bit. So yeah. So look at the Starbucks site right now, and I guess we need to take a screenshot to see it for later, but it was just, you know, it is kind of text heavy, and
And, you know, there's lots of square photos on the site and everything like that. So, I mean, but do you find that, you know, that's kind of a failing point of responsive web design, that, you know, it has to be a little bit more text heavy, or is that just the failing of the Starbucks in its execution?
No, I feel like most of them are text heavy. I mean, I think, you know, there's, you know, the right tool for the right job. And, you know, I definitely don't think that responsive is the answer to all sites.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
I get a lot of slack for that comment, but
no, I think I mean I'm glad you're saying that, because so many people are really on the responsive web. It is. It's almost, web.
And clients too. They're perceiving it as like a trend. It's almost like, yeah, make the button have rounded corners and give me a responsive site.
Right.
You know, it's becoming this like trend of like, I need this on my site, and this is definitely the right solution. But you know, it's not the right solution for every instance of it.
Right.
Right. When you have a web app, like you're talking about, I mean, there's all these places where responsive is difficult, like tables, for example. If you've got a lot of data, you have to come up with some clever solutions to make that, you know, say a 10-column table shrink down in a way that's readable on a phone. And that's a difficult design challenge to solve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think Ethan would be the first one to say that, you know, responsive web design, you know, isn't the end all be all for websites. Yeah. So, but yeah,
I'm pretty sure he's actually said that. And it's again, yes. it's having the right people kind of lead the way and saying, you know, like, this is, you know, again, it's in such early stages right now. There's still a lot that has to be figured out and learned.
Yeah. I think Ethan tweets that at least once a day.
Yeah. So, do you actually build sites for responsible design? Do you design different, if a client came to you today and say, like, hey, we have a website, we kind of like it, you know, or like, you know, what you've done so far, you know, And you made a point to, like, hey, it's going to cost you extra. Like, how much extra time do you think that would, you know, or do you know, based off past experience, like, extra time? And
I haven't done that much to really sit here and calculate it like that. Right. But yeah, I mean, it definitely is extra planning and extra time.
Yeah.
Especially because I feel like a lot of clients like to see the mock-up. You know, they like to see it before you kind of dive into the development, because then it's just a kind of a pain in the neck to show them once you get that far into the process. It's hard because, you know, then you got to sit there and, you know, figure out the grid, you know, and figure out how it's all going to scale down. What's going to happen to certain parts, you know, like the navigation, is it going to stay, you know, stacked? Is it going to be like a stack navigation? Is the navigation going to turn into a drop-down menu? I mean, you know, there's just a lot of different interactive elements that need to be considered for that.
Right.
So yeah, it does take more time. I'm not really sure at this point, though. I haven't done that many of them where I can really say, you know, how long it's been going to take.
Yeah, because like I'm just thinking just in general terms. It's just like, it's also a kind of a cry, because we talked to Christina Howerson. It was just like, you know, I feel like if you're going to do responsible design for a project, you need to do more of a content you know, upfront, even more so if we're to do multiple kind of versions of the same site, because not only do you have to get the content into like a traditional website fixed width layout content, but then you also have to like make those decisions as to what content to cut, and, you know, what the whole mobile first idea of like bringing things to the forefront, you know, on a mobile handheld device versus a web page. So
yeah.
And you see like it's we over there. So like is your business just beyond more than just you as a freelancer, or do you have other people helping you out?
Yeah, I have, like I said, I have a developer, Adam Clark, who does pretty much 100% of the development. Sometimes our clients will have an in-house team, you know, that takes over a certain part of it. But I always. I'm not a fan of handing over the design to the clients, just because a lot gets lost in translation. And you know, one thing when I was looking for a developer for my company was finding somebody that has a design eye. I feel like a lot of developers are, you know, they're head in the code, and they miss in a design what doesn't exist. You know, they miss the spacing, and they miss the rhythm of the page. mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, laying out, you know, text and imagery and, you know, yeah, so I these days I don't really do that much anymore.
Okay. Like in terms of developing, like, you mean like, just codifying up a page? Is that what you mean by developing?
Front end HTML, CSS.
Okay. Awesome.
So do you usually hand off to them, to your client, and then they integrate it to their CMS?
No, we'll take care of the CMS a lot of times, unless they want to. Like I said, we're lucky to work with a lot of people in the digital arena here. So a lot of them do have the manpower from a development and back end standpoint to, you know, do some things. But, you know, we try to do as much as possible. I just feel like it leaves the client happier, and they really, even if they don't see the true value at first, you know, that we kind of leave them with seeing the true value of having us, you know, start to finish and launch the site.
Yeah. What's your CMS of choice?
I'd say between WordPress and Expression Engine.
What makes you, I guess, like Expression Engine? Like what things about Expression Engine do you like?
That's more of Adam's choice.
I feel the buck passing. So yeah.
But you know, I can't give you a solid answer on that, because, like I said, in the past 3 years, I mean, I haven't. Man, the coding is just, you know, I stay on top of what's going on, but I don't have enough time to really dig into, you know, what's been changing on the WordPress scene, as opposed to, so I kind of leave that to Adam to sure. You know, make best judgment. He always does a really good job of that.
Yeah.
So you do a lot of work around brand development, right? Like designing logos and building an online brand. Yep. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Like what's involved in building a brand online?
Can you clarify, like, as far as our processes for that, or, well, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, maybe how would you recommend I'm a designer. I want to build a personal brand. I want to build my own, you know, brand for my business. I don't really know how to go about doing that. What kind of advice might you give to somebody in that position?
I won't get too much into it. I don't want to bore anybody, but if anybody wants to chat about it, I can later. I think a lot of, I think businesses seriously changed in the past few years. And I think a lot of this actually, you know, going, you know, deeper picture, you know, where companies are going, you know, under with this economy, I think there's just a major shift that people aren't quite understanding yet. You know, a lot of, it was funny. I was talking to my wife last night, and there was a guy that came up to our door, and he was trying to sell us on this pest control. and it was funny listening to him, because there was this whole, like, you know, this whole marketing gimmick, like, oh, you know what, I'm going to, you know, just because I'm here right now, I'm going to give you the lowest price possible. Like, I guarantee you said everybody else in the block. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I was just thinking, like, when you're online, we look to reviews of, like, real people that are using, you know, this, you know, the service or a product, mm-hmm. app. We don't really look anymore to, like, you know, what's this crap that's being said on the webpage. You know, best in show. You know, I used to live in Philly, and I used to see the world's first cheesesteak. You know, that's set on every cheesesteak stand around. So it's hard to kind of believe anybody when there's so many similar products out there. So I think through, like, good design, you're building that level of trust. You know, something that looks good is just trusted. You pay for, organic food, like, you know, and it has good packaging design, and it just, you know, something about it says organic just through the packaging design, beyond even reading what's in the ingredients. So I think being transparent online, and I built my brand through giving away free information. You know, people say, like, oh, you should have written a book and charged. And sure, I probably could have wrote a book and, you know, based on the information on my blog and charge because of it. But, you know, things have worked out, you know, otherwise. I think through being transparent online, I've, you know, built a trustworthy company, and, clients come to us because of that. So I'd say being transparent when it comes to your branding, you know, and personally, I mean, here's another statement I'll probably get in trouble with. I mean, a logo is a logo. I mean, how many times you sit there, even as a designer, I mean, even if I see a good logo, I'll be like, oh, that's an awesome logo. And 5 minutes ago, I forgot about it. Right. You know, but as long as it's memorable and it's well-designed and, it, you know, it'll translate, you know, and be one part of the mark that identifies your brand. Mm-hmm. But I think people need to spend less time marketing and more time, you know, making their product the best it can be.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think as designers often think that it's the logo that creates the brand, and that really the logo is an identifier that helps you remember the brand that you enjoy. You know, it wasn't the swoosh that made Nike this major company. You know, Nike became a major company, but the swoosh reminds us all the time of the experience we have with Nike products.
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of people kind of disassociate the logo from the brand, and they kind of think they are, you know, one of the same, but they're totally not.
So maybe now's a good time to sort of wrap up, and we like to talk about with our guests, we like to find out from them what they are excited about, what kind of changes or trends in web design or technology that you see that are happening now or on the horizon that are really exciting for you.
I'm a big fan of just a timeless design, and you know, it's kind of hard to pinpoint what exactly timeless is, but I usually feel like it's anything that's kind of not trending. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this, I think what's really nice is just, you know, simple design, focused design, I think a good example of that is the new RDO.com marketing site. They just do a really beautiful job of being as simple as possible, great imagery, you know, nothing fancy, but just, you know, really hardcore fundamental design principles that are just showcased, you know, on that site alone. The guys behind it, they always do really good work, Ryan Sims and company.
Which site is this? I don't know it.
It's RDIO.com. It's a really great service too. I'm not here promoting it, but I don't know what I would do without RDIO. it's basically like I guess most people are familiar with Spotify. It's the same idea. It's really focused more towards the social aspect, which, you know, the older I get, the more uncool I am with finding new music. So I love
totally.
And then I go to like the young kids, like, oh, you hear about this band? I found it.
That's great. That's an excellent point, is that I think often with the web, we get really obsessed with what's trending and what's on the horizon and what the newest CSS properties are, and even the newer, with the newest technologies, can I bring Node.js in this thing and do something with that? Yeah. You know, but that there are, you know, fundamentals. There are things that we need to keep our eyes on in terms of creating a brand and creating a look and sort of design, you know, principles that have been true forever, and they're true in print and online, and that we should never, you know, lose sight of those things, because those are things that will ground us forever in our career, even as the technologies change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, how can people find you on the internets and the Twitters and all that sort of thing?
My blog is the Design Cubicle, thedesigncubicle.com.
That was awesome. We were really dedicated to spelling the whole thing out. Really,
that's really funny. Either people they skip the "the."
Yeah.
So they'll just search Design Cubicle or type that in, come right up, or they spell cubicle wrong a lot, I found. I have no idea why, but they do. Yeah. And then my other site is just brianhoff.net, not .com. There's been a guy who's a designer who hasn't updated it in, I'm going to say like since like 1990. He's just squatting on that because he knows I want it. That's a joke. Go write him a nasty email.
Yeah, wow. I'm checking that site out now. I can't. Wow, yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. All right, Brian. Well, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you and learning about what you do and really talking about design.
Yeah, likewise. It was a pleasure being here.
Our thanks to Brian Hoff for joining us on Non-Breaking Space. You can check out the show notes for this episode at nonbreakingspace.tv, where we'll have all the links discussed in this episode. As well, we're on Twitter at NBSPTV and on Facebook, which you can find by searching Non-Breaking Space. Be sure to watch for the next episode of Non-Breaking Space to hear Eric Meyer say,
"Weep! Ding! Hey, everyone, I got mail. Did you all hear that?"